eyes and debating whether I could accept a room service order without a bra on. Like, what if it's more than an exchange of plates or whatever, and I have to awkwardly tuck my tits into my armpit to sign a receipt? I like traveling to other places to do the exact same thing I do at home. Read books in bed, occasionally get overpriced takeout, and groan exasperatedly at tourists chattering excitedly outside my door over whatever thrilling activity they are about to go do. Shit we did in Nashville, in no particular order. Saw Dave Chappelle's return to stand-up. Ate donuts in the parking lot of the Donut Den during a tornado. Learned what a meat and three is. Cried while eating Hattie B's hot chicken. Listened to a terrible version of that Black Velvet song sung by your drunk stepmom at this overcrowded bar with delicious okra. Drove around all damn day Easter Sunday, looking for an inconspicuous place that wasn't a golf course or children's playground to dump a giant can of ashes without alerting anyone to our possibly illegal agenda. Xanax. Shit we did not do in Nashville. Go to the Country Music Hall of Fame. See the Parthenon. Hit the Grand Ole Opry. Venture outside a whole lot. Eat anything we probably couldn't find in Chicago. Talk to anyone other than my friend Lena, who was living in Nashville for work. Much of anything, really. Even when I had stopped believing in God as a teenager, I would still drag myself to church once a year to contemplate my mortality while celebrating the risen Christ and surveying all the elaborate headpieces worn by the women of the congregation for Easter service. When I was little and forced week after week to attend our death-boring Methodist services, Easter was always a welcome change. Better songs, a well-rehearsed play, a fierier sermon. Plus, Easter has the best candy, so of course it was my favorite. To this day, I weep like a child when those purple bags of Cadbury mini eggs show up in the Walgreens seasonal aisle at the first dawn of spring. I didn't have very much of an attachment to that dusty can of gravel. I don't know if I'm a robot or dead inside or what, or if the passing of time leeches the sentimentality out of loss. But guilt was the only emotion keeping me from just dropping it in a garbage can outside of a 7-Eleven. I'm not much for ceremony either. If ever there is a wedding in my future, you can bet your sweet ass that it'll take place in some nondescript room in a courthouse, followed immediately by appetizers and margaritas at the closest Chili's. I don't like to make a big to-do. Although it did seem fitting to sprinkle his ashes on Easter, if for no other reason than to see if I'd find him randomly hanging out in my kitchen 3 days later. I wasn't sure how to appropriately eulogize a dude who had once punched me in the face for washing the dishes wrong, and it really never occurred to me that I might write something down for the occasion. People always assume that because I'm a writer, I just show up to special events with some super poignant shit written on a scroll in my purse. I write butt jokes on the internet, you guys. Please stop asking me to say a few words at your kid's baptism. Also, the only semi-private spot on the river we found after driving around in the nice clothes I remembered at the very last second to pack was a very public boat launch down a sharp incline. Even though it was 3 in the afternoon, I was terrified that some kids out to enjoy the shit-smelling river on a warm day in a kayak would happen upon us and call the fucking police. I read To Kill a Mockingbird. I'm not trying to be caught with a pretty white woman doing anything. So even if I had written a speech, I would have been too fucking jittery to read it. I could tell that Mavis was dismayed by my bored lack of liturgy, so I made a big show of slowly prying the lid off the can while I tried to come up with something moving to say. "Is it tacky to Instagram this?" I asked her, but before she could answer, a car full of hooting and laughing teenagers crunch through the gravel at the top of the hill and park next to the idling Toyota. And I, for real, was not trying to explain just what the fuck we were doing to a bunch of children who were about to go skinny dipping in my father's cremains. It's bad manners just to dump him in the water. Shouldn't you at least say something nice? Mavis asked, a borderline hysterical edge creeping into her voice. I waited for the wind to die down while keeping an anxious eye on the cut-off shorts and tank tops untying the boat from their SUV above us. Thanks for always cutting my meat into tiny pieces, I said finally, tipping the can toward the gently rippling waves. The sun sparkled on the surface of the water, which remained blissfully undisturbed as nothing was coming out of that fucking can. If I have to touch these ashes with my bare hands, I am going to kill myself, I barked at Mavis, who stood downriver, wringing her hands nervously and keeping her eyes trained on the whooping and hollering kids stripping down to their bikinis up by the car. I shook the can a little harder. Still nothing. What a fucking asshole, undoubtedly mocking me from the other side of the Rainbow Bridge. Stop embarrassing me, I hissed, banging the side of the container to loosen him up. Gross. Before violently shaking it out over the water. As the better part of the cremains shook loose from where they had settled, a huge gust of wind came from the east. Of fucking course. Mavis's face was like Munch's scream painting, all horrified, wide eyes and open mouth, as I turned toward her with my dead father's charred bones and fingernails splattered across my face and crackling between my teeth. It was like coming home from a day at the beach, except replace sand with gritty Sam Irby penis and entrails lining my nostrils and in between my toes. Fuck, I shouted, tasting burned human flesh on my tongue as I shook eyeballs and elbows off my dress. What hadn't ended up in my face hole was floating like a large clump of dust slowly down the Cumberland River. Is that really all there is? I've had more pomp and circumstance while taking out the fucking recycling. Horrified, I stood frozen at the edge of the water. As we climbed back up the hill, past those children whose lives I would be living if happiness weren't a goddamn lie, I could feel bits and particles squelching between my toes. I made a mental note that this would be the last day of my life that I was going to ever wear motherfucking flip-flops. Mavis drove to Bolton's Spicy Chicken and Fish so we could get a couple of pieces to take back to the hotel, and I stood outside the car in the parking lot, bent over a trash can, shaking out my hair and digging little black specks out of my ears while she flirted with the old dude frying up her catfish inside the restaurant. I tossed the gold funeral home can in a dumpster and said one last thank you to my father for blessing me with short, fat fingers that couldn't get as deep into my ear canals as I needed them to go. When we got back to the hotel, I contemplated plucking out each of my eyelashes one by one, shaving my entire body, eyebrows included, then hosing it down with bleach. But SVU was on. Plus, we had just gotten some ribs. So instead, I took a Klonopin and brushed my teeth in the hot shower, wondering which of my dad's parts I was watching ride a frothy cloud of extra-strength dandruff shampoo down the drain. Roll credits. Sad trombone. I'm in love, and it's boring. I found the apartment in the rental listings of the Chicago Reader. The ad was for a spacious, airy, unbelievably huge one-bedroom, not far from the one my roommate and I were currently arguing about dirty dishes in. $600 a month, no credit check, no deposit. Move in today. I called the number and was bounced between receptionists before finally getting one who could help. We scheduled a viewing for later that day, and I was pleasantly surprised to find an apartment that really was massive, not the shoebox I'd been expecting, with large windows that flooded the space with light and gleaming hardwood floors. I knew I wanted it the minute I crossed the threshold, but I went through the motions of peeking into the closet and checking the water pressure in the shower so the landlord could rest assured that I was a serious person. I offered him the first 2 months' rent in cash on the spot, and he handed me a basic lease to sign and said I could move in whenever I wanted. After I closed the door behind him, I sat on the closed toilet and texted my boyfriend. Dude, I found us the perfect place. When I was in love with Zachary Jones, I knew it because my stomach used to hurt whenever I thought about his face, and I would drag myself barefoot around that apartment we were supposed to be sharing, drinking cold vodka in my pajamas while listening to Wake Up Alone by Amy Winehouse and waiting for him to text me. I knew it was love because I was 26 and had crashed my 1987 Honda Accord in the parking lot outside of Pizzeria Aroma when, over the cell phone I shouldn't have been talking on while driving, he said, "I love you," and sounded like he meant it. I knew it was love because he gave me a mix CD 3 weeks after he ghosted on my birthday party. The party was also supposed to be a, "This is my actual boyfriend, not just some imaginary guy I've been talking your ear off about" party, so I sat there pink-cheeked and burning with shame while everyone asked where he was, again. It was always my young dream to fall in love with a DJ. I was a very earnest club-goer, and when I wasn't shuffling around the dance floors at Slick's and Cinnabar and Betty's Blue Star, I was studying records at Gramophone. I fantasized about hauling bags of house records to my car from the darkroom at 2 a.m., my clothes damp with sweat, sticky with spilled drinks, and reeking of cigarette smoke. I daydreamed about late nights fighting through crowds to fetch bottles of water from the bar for the faceless imaginary boyfriend hunched over the tables, oversized headphones bobbing as he nodded to the beat. I barely slept, toiling all day at my various jobs before racing home to slam a quick dinner and draw on some eyeliner before leaving right back out to go to the club. I met Zach at an MF Doom show at Sonotech, a place I loved so much I cried when it closed. I was actually there with another dude, this younger kid, Jason, who I was trying to figure out whether or not I had feelings for. And Zach stood watching us huddled together, shouting unintelligibly into each other's ears. When I realized this giant human nursing the same beer for 45 minutes was staring at me, I figured it was because I was wearing gym shoes in a disco and tried to hide my feet behind my bag. For 2 hours, he watched me over the heads of tiny backpackers, furiously composing battle raps in their heads, until the show ended and the lights went up, and everyone scattered like roaches to the darkest corners of the room. Zach had disappeared. Had I dreamed him? So I hovered awkwardly near the bar, waiting for my friends to pee and close their tabs, and tried to shake off that shy, embarrassed feeling you get when you think someone likes you, but you figure out they were really interested in your friend or some shit. I smelled him before I saw him. Clean like soap, yet spicy and masculine. All of a sudden, a stubbled cheek pressed against mine as he bent close to speak. His lips smelled like Carmex. "Is that dude you were sitting with your boyfriend?" His voice pierced my heart like a knife, and my voice caught in my throat. I shook my head, deciding right then and there that my feelings for Jason were most definitely of the friendly variety. He asked for my number, and I mentally had to calculate whether there was enough money in my bank account to get my cell phone reactivated by the time he was going to call me. I could probably hustle up a freelance copy editing job right quick and get Sprint their money. So if he was one of these cool guys and waited a few days, I'd be all good. But what if he, you know, liked me and try to call later that day. Then I'd either look like a broke bitch or a lying asshole. And yeah, I'm probably both, but he ain't gotta know that yet. I snatched a pen off the bar and wrote down the number to the house phone I had initially sneered at when my roommate insisted. Thank goodness for sensible people. He smiled, revealing a row of perfect teeth that stood in stark contrast to his deep chocolate skin, even in the almost dark, and enveloped my hand in his big bear paw. My insides turned to jelly, and I fought the desire to get on my tiptoes and kiss him. The courtship was amazing. Until I met him, I had been an unwitting victim of a lot of Netflix and chilling, except that wasn't a thing then. Let's just say I spent a lot of nights on various boy-friendly futons, watching HBO for whatever amount of time is long enough to feel like a not-prostitute before having unenthusiastic sex. I was 25, man. No one was asking me to dinner. It was like, oh, hey, cool, you gave me your number at that De La show. Want to come over and watch me and my roommates play Resident Evil for 3 hours? So I would say yeah, and shave my legs, and get all my shit on, and go to some kid's house to watch him smoke weed and play Xbox, and then when he lost, we'd go to his room and have loser sex atop the pizza boxes and Jordans and DVDs scattered across his bed. And by have sex, I mean lie stiff as a board with all my muscles taut so his roommates wouldn't hear the bed squeaking. Lather, rinse, repeat for the entirety of my early 20s until this adult human male picked a time and a restaurant that served food on real plates. In the cab on the way home, I whispered to myself, this is it. I knew it was love because he was busy with school, and I was not busy, at least not busy in big and important ways. And it's cute when you're not busy to mail care packages to your boyfriend who literally lives 30 minutes away but hasn't called in a week because he is so fucking busy. That inner cringe when a friend asks, have you ever been in his house, is obviously what love feels like. I was in a pretty hopeless place, working too much, sick all the time, desperate to be loved in a real way. I needed an anchor, and into my lap one fell. He talked about helping me finish school and taking me on tropical vacations and didn't care that I can't have babies. How did I get so lucky? And all I would have to do in return was wait while trying not to drown. I became pretty good at pretending to be a super chill girlfriend, but sometimes I felt like I was really going to lose my shit pacing around that apartment waiting for updates. Would he get out of class early enough to hang out tonight? Could he take Saturday night off from work to meet me out for a drink? What about if I drove to the hospital during his lunch break and just made googly eyes at him in the harshly lit cafeteria for a few minutes? Hours stretched to days, and days stretched to weeks, and there I was trying to be cool while pining for someone too unavailable to be my boyfriend, secretly delighting in the agony because it was proof that I was actually, no, fucking finally, in an adult romantic relationship. I would bore my increasingly irritated friends with melodramatic whining about how my one true love didn't have time to hang out because of his chemistry final, then sit alone in this new apartment I'd rented so I could give him a key without being disrespectful to my now ex-roommate. A key he used maybe 3 times over the course of our entire relationship, because he never found the time to come over. I knew I was in love, because even though I spent my weekends locked in my crib, organizing my catch-ups and moping around to heartbreak music, it was worth it, because I could finally relate to what the hell those bitches were singing about. I had mastered the unrequited crush early in life. Every boy who leaned over to help me solve a geometry problem, or who smacked a volleyball back over the net before it smashed into my face, became the object of my never-ending devotion. until he asked someone else to homecoming, and I learned, again, that just because a dude runs across the whole school with the clarinet you left behind in the band room tucked under his arm to bring it to your Latin American history class doesn't mean he's in love with you. Sometimes people can be decent. So I gathered all the songs about loneliness and longing and made bleak mixtapes to listen to while ripping pictures of Christian Slater out of back issues of YM and 17. And that was fine, but what I really wanted was a reason to sing all the tortured, love-gone-wrong songs. What I really wanted was to sing Tear in Your Hand at the top of my lungs and mean it. I had sex one time in high school, but that was a joke. As soon as he squirted that thick ribbon of cum all over my pubes and inner thigh before I'd even begun to enjoy myself, I decided that I wouldn't be doing that with a person I might have to do a group project on NAFTA with ever fucking again. In my later teens, I'd learned the hard way that sex doesn't equal undying romantic feelings. But boy, those first few lessons were brutal. They resulted in many, "Yo, I thought we were just homies who kicked it sometimes," conversations. So when I finally happened upon this handsome stranger, one who had all the hobbies and interests of the prototypical lovers I breathlessly detailed in my journals, one who took me on dates that he paid for, one who made actual love instead of trying to fuck me in the face, I thought it was kismet. It had to be. So what if he didn't ever have time to have long philosophical talks with me, or fit a quick lunch into his grad school schedule? He told me he loved me and wanted to spend his life with me, and he proved it by never ever calling or using the extra toothbrush I'd carefully arranged in the medicine cabinet in what should have been our bathroom. All I had when I moved was some pots and pans and the shit in my bedroom, so the dining room and living room and guest room sat cold and empty for the entire time I lived there, letting the words "To Carrion" by Fiona Apple echo through the empty spaces, waiting for him to give me a reason to fill them up. The torture of loving someone through difficult circumstances seemed so glamorous in music and on television. I knew I was in love because opposite work schedules and organic chemistry were conspiring to keep the two of us apart. What cruel irony to meet the 7-foot-tall, record-collecting beefcake of my dreams, only to be prioritized somewhere between get a root canal and study for the MCAT on his to-do list. I spent years of my life romanticizing something that amounted to little more than the kind of relationship a person has with her high school boyfriend once they've gone away to separate colleges, and he forgets there's someone pining for him halfway across the country. The gut-wrenching pain of casual rejection was my oxygen as I waited for him to put his stethoscope down long enough to help me pick out a couch. At least I got a lot of shit done while waiting for him to finish school. I circled a lot of particle board furniture in the IKEA catalog, fucked a couple of muscular jerks with fat fetishes I brought home from the gym, and read the entire Harry Potter series during the summer I unknowingly was waiting for him to dump me. God, I was dumb and cautiously optimistic for way longer than I should have been. I mean, in love. How do I know I'm in love if I don't want to kill myself all the time? Mavis is the nicest person I've ever met, and it was hard to recognize I was in love with her because she never let so much time elapse between, "Hey, what's up," winky face emoji texts that I had deleted her number and had to respond, "New phone, who dis?" She has never replied, okay, sure, when I tell her I love her. She's never patted me on the back while telling me that she thinks of me as a really good friend, despite our regular carnal relations. Never said, "Nah, I don't read your shit because you really aren't that funny to me." Never disappeared for a month and then popped back up all nonchalant. She has never, not even once, made me miserable. How is it possible that what we have is even real? You know how when you're in your mid to late 30s and you're dreaming about where you're going to live, hopefully by age 42, and you're picturing your reasonably affordable one-bedroom apartment in a moderately safe and attractive neighborhood? Who is living there with you? Is it the withholder? The serial cheater? What about the commitment phobe, or perhaps the grifter? Yeah, no, it's none of those. It's some mythical being you haven't met yet, one who doesn't have any suspicious Facebook activity that can trigger hours of pointless scrolling down strangers' profiles looking for infidelity clues. I have developed a very special set of skills as a coping mechanism for falling in love with shitty people. I can go days at a time without so much as a smoke signal. I have no problem eating in a restaurant alone, or living without physical contact for weeks, or believing that a person who definitely was sleeping with several other women was also somehow devoted to me. That's the deal, right? That it's not real unless it feels like someone reached into your chest to pull your heart out while you stand by helplessly? I can work with that. I have not, however, figured out what to do when a person I am romantically involved with keeps her word and looks after my feelings. If Mavis showed up at a reading, drunk and inexplicably wet, and heckled me on stage, I would know how to handle that kind of love. I understand a love that argues with you in public and occasionally puts down your body and knocks on your door only at midnight. I've never been loved like this before, and I resist it every day because I do not deserve it. Real love feels less like a throbbing, pulsing animal begging for its freedom and beating against the inside of my chest, and more like, hey, that place you like had fish tacos today, and I got you some while I was out, as it sets a bag spotted with grease on the dining room table. It's not a game you don't understand the rules of, or a test you never got the materials to study for. It never leaves you wondering who could possibly be texting at 3 a.m., or what you could possibly do to make it come home and stay there. It's fucking boring, dude. I don't walk around mired in uneasiness, waiting for the other shoe to drop. No parsing through spun tales about why it took her so long to come back from the store. No checking her emails or calling her job to make sure she's actually there. No sitting in my car outside her house at dawn to make sure she's alone when she leaves. This feels safe and steadfast and predictable and secure. It's boring as shit, and it's easily the best thing I've ever felt. Today is Zach's 43rd birthday. We met on the eve of his 32nd. That totally blows my mind. Like, how can I be this old? How could this have all gone down a decade ago? And how are the scars lurking under the surface of my skin still so easy to find? I remember the first time I ran into him in public after we'd broken up. My friend Julia and I were at the Silver Room block party, withering under the blistering July sun, when I heard a familiar laugh behind me and my stomach fell right out of my butt. I turned around and made eye contact, then immediately started to cry, but all cool-like behind giant sunglasses. It felt like all the wind had been sucked out of my lungs, an acute pain that I could feel radiating through my whole body. I clutched Julia's arm, tears streaming down my cheeks, and was like, yo, I gotta go, right now. And then we pushed our way through the crowd of sweaty, gyrating bodies to get a cab home. It had been, I don't know, 6 or 7 months. And I thought I was fine after we broke up. I didn't fall apart like I thought I would. But when I saw him again, something cracked open inside me, and I went home to my new apartment, this time just one room, big enough for a full-size bed, a bookcase, a kitchen big enough to wedge a little writing desk under the window, and a bathroom the size of a closet, perfect for the three boxes I'd moved in with, and called a friend to say that I thought I might be dying for real, and played Portishead records in the dark for the rest of the night. Reminded, again, that love feels like a fucking dumpster fire in the pit of your stomach. I saw the little gift icon on my iPhone calendar this morning and immediately texted him, which I have not done in literal years. But this is a sign, right? Randomly digging up all these fucking feelings on the anniversary of his birth without even having realized it? I have never written about him, and I never planned to. I like to make fun of people, especially myself, but I've always felt so protective of that 25-year-old idiot moping around those barren rooms with her barren womb, feeling so grateful for the hope that came attached to this person. I had no idea whether he had the same number, but I wrote, "Happy, happy day, champ," and pressed send. He wrote back within minutes, which never happened when we were together. "How you doing? Blah, blah. What are you up to? Blah, blah. How's your family? Blah, blah, blah. Are you seeing anyone?" And then he said, "I regret how we ended our relationship, because I really thought something permanent would have come about with you. But I see now that it was bad timing. We had a lot of laughs together. Your soul is always with me, and I always keep you close to me. And yes, I know it was hard as hell, but one thing you should know is that I really loved you, and I never stopped." 8 years ago, reading that would have melted the stalactites hanging from his space in my heart, formed by ice that thickened every time I changed my outgoing voicemail message so it would sound like it belonged to a carefree person who obviously had missed his call because she was too busy out having fun. The ice that had grown thicker still with every evening spent cleaning the top of the refrigerator and polishing the faucets and all the other pointless shit you do when you think your boyfriend is coming over and you want him to know how clean and put together you are. 8 years ago, I would have poured myself a drink and put on some red lipstick and rented a hotel room in the hopes of seeing whether our bodies still fit together the way they used to. I sat with that text for a minute before responding with this. "I really loved you, my man. We could have been a good thing." Which is probably lies, but it doesn't even matter, because this is now, and I'm totally fucking bored. A bomb, probably. Everyone I know is having a goddamn baby. And what that means is you can't just stop by your homegirl's house unannounced with a bottle of Carmenere and a couple of tubes of Pringles to watch hours of makeup tutorial videos on YouTube anymore. Because that baby might be sleeping, or eating, or doing its taxes, and you are going to mess it all up with your loud, single-person bullshit. That baby does not have time to listen to an in-depth analysis of the string of unanswered text messages you recently sent to your latest unrequited crush. Nor does it have time to deconstruct the most recent episode of The Bachelorette. Unless you're coming over armed with a bowl of creamed peas and a cardboard book for that kid to chew on, just stay in your tragic, one-person dwelling and hope like hell that the next person they hire at work will be someone not stupid to whom you can relate. I am in a relationship now with a woman who has children, and let me just say that most certainly was not how I was expecting my destiny to knit itself together. I thought for sure I would be spending my stress incontinence years picking moist dog food crumbs out of my aging Shih Tzu's slobbery beard, while earnestly considering circuit court judicial endorsements in my local newspaper. But now it looks like I really do have to learn what Molly is and how to know if your kid is on it. Being in a relationship has turned me into a total asshole. Hold up. Not that kind. I still don't vote regularly or eat rutabaga or use words like plethora in regular conversation. But I do lame stuff like thinking about my future and putting money away just in case. Right now I'm quote-unquote babysitting, and here's what that looks like. The girl child is in the sunroom gobbling high fructose corn syrup by the handful, watching irritatingly loud cartoons and building a bomb, probably, and I'm in the dining room paralyzed with fear that she might ask me to tell her a story or cook her something nutritious or, God forbid, help her with her homework. These kids are going to find out real quick that my perceived intelligence is a web of lies built on a crumbling foundation of charm and quick wit. The other night, the boy child was working on his algebra homework at the dinner table, and when he asked me to look over a problem, I was like, LOL, and pretended to be choking on a Brussels sprout. I was doing some long division by hand yesterday, and dude blurted, "Is that even math?" while squinting at the numbers and turning the paper upside down and shit. "I think it's hieroglyphics," murmured the girl. "Bitch, I don't know new math. I don't even know how to figure out a 20% tip on an odd-numbered check." Want to know the hardest thing I've ever had to do? Not yell a string of offensive curse words when I banged my finger in a kitchen drawer with an impressionable child in the room. I've had colonoscopies that were easier than holding my pulsating hand in a dish towel and looking into those wide blue child eyes and simply saying, "Ouch." In my mind, I was kicking every stupid pot and pan in that motherfucker while howling, "Shit, fuck you, son of a bitching dick," and foaming at the mouth. But kids don't need to hear that. So I just took a handful of aspirin and ground my molars into stumps as pain radiated up my arm. 5 years ago, at a cozy, sunlit corner table at our favorite breakfast spot, my friend Anna looked up at me from her bowl of chia porridge with tears shining in her eyes and said, "Samantha, I'm pregnant." And I started crying because she's been my friend since we were 10 years old and I love her more than anything. Then she said, "It's two babies. They're the size of lentils." And by that point, we were both sobbing and hugging, and curious onlookers shot us scathing death looks because the brunch line at that place is always bananas. I made a concerted effort not to reach out and put my hands on her belly because I read somewhere that that's rude. And please somebody give me a medal for that restraint. I couldn't believe that this jerk who wore hemp necklaces and put Ben Harper on every single mixtape she made in high school was about to be somebody's mother. Technically, two somebody's. Horrifying. I became an aunt to my sister's kid when I was 6, but that was way different. My niece was never going to look across the backseat of Mom's Chevy at where I was buckled into the booster seat and wonder why I hadn't put a down payment on any property yet. She never questioned why her adult aunt was sneaking her lunch of neon orange mac and cheese directly from the pot it had dried in because she didn't have any food at home and her direct deposit hadn't cleared the bank yet. I'm sure that Anna and her fine-ass Canadian husband had already started setting aside money for those lentils to go to college, but shouldn't they have asked me if I was ready for kids, if I had enough fun aunt money set aside for regular trips to the American Girl store, if I had the energy to pack up my apartment and move into a place someone had already childproofed, if I was ready to stop shouting swear words all the time. I am HCG challenged, and at an age when all my late nights and drunken partying is dangerously towing the line between fabulous and exciting and sad as a motherfucker. The age at which the sluts I used to drink too much and cry with are all dressed like Kohl's ads, driving sport utility vehicles with roof racks affixed to them, and having stable relationships with men who wear sensible shoes and make wise investments with their beer money. God damn it. Is there anyone left who wants to be drunk at 3 in the afternoon and go get manicures? I see you, potential new friend, banging terrible dudes, drinking backwashed beer some stranger just left on the bar, and basically whiling away your early 30s pretending that your life is an extended episode of Sex and the City, when all of a sudden, boom. Every vagina within a 10-mile radius is pushing out an 8-pound, screaming red ball of human who will eventually need braces and many winter coats. And you and I are still eating cheese fries and jelly beans for dinner. I swear, now that I am finally beginning to come to terms with being that special kind of pig person who is barely treading water while being neck deep in a frothy sea of embossed wedding invitations heaved at me by my so-called friends, it seems others have come up with a whole new way to make me feel like an emotionally stunted teenage boy. They are creating new people. No big deal, right? Yes, everybody knows somebody who was pushing a stroller to class in the 9th grade. But back then, it was like, too bad you have to take your baby to gym class. I'll just be over here wearing my velvet choker and sobbing to Liz Phair. Now it's like, girl, you are making me feel like a lesser human being. My dead parents aren't around to harp on me about my slow grandchild production, and while I am grateful for that little bit of orphan silver lining, no one told me that, having already survived a series of teenage years during which bodysuits were the rage, my 30s would be another unimaginable assault on my very low self-esteem. The twins started kindergarten last fall, and every year I am still one day early or 2 days late for their birthday. I forget when they're within earshot and say mean things about dead people or recount in excruciating detail the highlights of my most recent gynecological exam. My friends and frenemies all have little ones now, and I'm not any smarter or feeling any more put together. Plus, when I visit them, I can't set my bag down anywhere for fear of dropping a metal flask onto some tiny, soft skull. If it gets better, I'ma need to know when. I suppose I could just wait for all their children to drop out of dental school and stab a convenience store employee while trying to steal a box of real Sudafed before I feel haughty and superior about my choice to let everyone else do the breeding. But with my luck, these little dudes are going to grow up to be, like, funny and charming Instagram models who automatically take my arm when we're walking in the snow. I hate them already. You can't tell by looking, but I was a nanny for a while in high school and through my early 20s. It was just like The Help, except swap in liberal white guilt and Land Rovers for Jim Crow and cotton gins. The most important thing I learned was the difference between the boxed macaroni and cheese parents and the holistic kale anti-vaccination parents. Macaroni moms are the easiest to be around, obviously, because, duh, you can totally let their kids zombie out in front of the TV and order a sausage pizza. I am not good enough to be around my no-screens-in-the-house flaxseed friends. For real, I can't be having your kid in our adult conversation because you don't want him to get high on Sesame Street and fruit snacks. Go away, baby. And I have neither the intelligence nor the patience to navigate the kid aisle at Whole Foods while trying to find the gluten-free, carob-sweetened, agave soy organic vegan oxygenated wheatgrass bites or whatever, so that my newest nephew has something to snack on while trying to stay alive for 2 hours in my apartment. I might put my knives away and hide the porn, but educational toys and petroleum-free jellies are not within my purview. You need to know all this stuff, of course, because some of these new moms will lose their impacted shit on you if they catch you pouring anything other than Hawaiian volcanic water into their child's bath. Yes, that same person you watched pull a disgusting dollar bill from between a stripper's ass cheeks with her teeth will now try to break your jaw for serving her kids some cheese with hormones in it. And she's not wrong. She just needs to understand that I don't know what the fuck a heart of palm even is, Katie. That's why I took the boy to McDonald's. They serve apples now, shit. And I've changed plenty of cloth diapers in my day, but it is not humanly possible for me to stay on top of all the ways I might be destroying your young offspring. There's only so much reading and interacting I can do, parents. I have come to find out that the only leverage you can get on a kid is doing something that he's too young to do. And since 10-year-olds these days are already refinancing their second mortgages and maintaining better 401ks than I do, the best way to stay ahead of the game is to do things that they legally can't, like going under the needle and drinking a High Life with your breakfast. You have to find a way in with kids, and if they're old enough to figure out what a total loser you are, you have to do it immediately. Danger and contraband are the currency of youth, and the less similar to their responsible, bill-paying parents you seem, the better you'll get along with your surrogate children. That's why when Auntie Sam comes over to babysit, she brings dirty needles and a ComEd disconnect notice in her purse. They're putty in my hands after I tell them what it's like to run out of toilet paper and how to disguise your voice when you accidentally answer a collections call. The fact that I live somewhere else and am not fussing at them to clean up their Legos is usually enough to hit the cool points jackpot. But when I need a boost, I tell them about the one time I got into a bar brawl, or that time I got shot. I never got shot. If your idiot friends start procreating while you're still trying to get on the VIP list at the club every week, you definitely have to learn baby talk. Not goo goo gaga, you asshole. You need to learn what Montessori means. Seriously, you better verse yourself in home births and butt paste, because gone are the days when your girl has time to listen to you whine about that one dude with the nice car who never called you after he teabagged you in the parking lot behind a bowling alley. You are going to be talking about baby poop. All the time. Its smell, its consistency, its color, its length, its taste, whatever. Prepare to let your life be taken over by infant diarrhea. And while we're at it, you better get accustomed to looking at some giant lactating boobs, because your breastfeeding friends will have zero qualms about unhooking their flesh-colored, front-loading bras right in the middle of your dinner. And don't worry about being a pervert for staring, because it might be the least sexual event you will ever see in your life. All that rooting around and the squishing noises. When Anna was in town when the girls were 6 weeks old, she was partially naked half the time and like 80% disoriented, and I had to learn quick how to conduct a conversation without trying to gauge the size and shape of my best friend's exposed areolas. But even if public boobs freak you out, you won't even care, because every time that tiny alien screams its little head off, demanding food, or a diaper, or a change of scenery, all you'll want is for her to get those jugs out and shut that noise up. Oh my God, the money. You thought what you had to spend when the parents got married was bad? Well, hold on to your prepaid Visa card, friend, because that was only the beginning. At least weddings happen only one time. Babies have birthdays every year. 3 times a month I'm standing in Target, squinting to read the instructions on some inappropriate toy or another, trying to figure out whether it makes too much noise or requires too much skill or comes equipped with too many parts a little kid could choke on and die from, only to then fuck up the wrapping paper and spill vodka on the card the kid can't even read yet when I get home. You will need to take out a monster loan. Or if your credit is messed up, you better start waiting tables during all your single-person free time. You won't mind, though, because your exhausted BFF will smile so hard and be so grateful that you picked up a pack of onesies on your way over to regale her with stories from your super exciting, STD-dodging, single girl life. By the end of the first month, you will be seriously considering signing up for the Babies R Us email list. Because baby stuff is cute, and seeing a little diarrhea-soaked human being dressed in a perfectly matched outfit that you bought for him is an incredible feeling, especially if he is too young to tell you how much he hates it and how all the other kids at school get their bibs from Gucci. You won't be able to walk by a pastel display at Walmart without dumping half of it into your cart. You'll coo at little monkeys and bears and marvel at the tininess of little frilly socks, spending your way to eviction because the asshole you sat next to in U.S. history junior year couldn't figure out how to properly use a condom, and you will love it. Try not to feel too salty when going through your bank statements, or just be like me and never open them. Just keep in mind that eventually those kids will be old enough to drive you around and send you cards and look after your cats while you're in Florida for the winter. And couple friends with baby friends are the best because they always have extra stuff just lying around for your pitiful single ass to mooch off them. No way in hell I'm going to Sam's Club. That's why I keep smug marrieds around. I haven't bought my own toilet paper in 3 years. I just wait until one of them is like, come eat dinner with us, you lonely piece of shit. And while the fish sticks are heating up, Mom and Dad pack me suitcases full of 2-ply, extra-strong, kid-proof toilet paper and economy-sized bags of animal crackers. The friends with deep freezers and large pantries are even better, because you can walk out of there with 19 individually wrapped chicken breasts, 4 bottles of toilet bowl cleaner, 1,000 count boxes of Swiffer cloths, a 10-pound bag of frozen shrimp, and 6 pints of strawberries. Who needs Peapod? People with kids are so exhausted they don't have time to notice that one of the 46 boxes of Kleenex they just purchased is missing. They literally have no idea what is in their houses at any given moment. If something is gone or broken, they'll just assume one of the kids did it. You think I'm kidding, but the last time I bought Ziploc bags, Gladware containers, handy wipes, sponges, dish towels, and Q-tips was, never. That's what baby friends are for. This year, on my days off, I'm trying to stay up super late. It's 10:37 at night right now. Who am I, a rapper? And sleep as late as I possibly can. Now that a lot of my friends are having babies, the only recourse I have against feeling like a huge dork for still trying to maneuver my way through my first real romance is doing all the things those mother hens can't do anymore. I curse at the top of my lungs in the solitude of my apartment, eat pizza for breakfast, take several long, uninterrupted showers every day, turn my phone off, watch R-rated movies, poop in blissed-out peace, buy unpasteurized cheese and pointy furniture, leave my vibrator in the dish drain after I wash it, never ever watch public television, but also never turn the television off, get some mercury-laden sushi, spend an entire day reading under the covers, go out for drinks, throw away all of my bite-sized foods, make sandcastles in the cat litter box, never buy any fresh fruit, use my outside voice inside, take a bunch of Tylenol and a bunch of Advil, and don't forget, drink a shitload of cold medicine. The Real Housewife of Kalamazoo. The only time I fantasize about jettisoning my fast-paced, action-packed, exciting city for the Purelled, easy-to-park-your-oversized-vehicle embrace of the suburbs is when I think about how nice it would be to never have to race the motherfucking zip car from Target to the Whole Foods Hot Bar to the laundromat in under 3 hours ever fucking again. strip malls are boring, and children are so fucking loud. But there is something to be said for the ability to deposit your car right in front of the window that you will be hawkishly staring out of for half the night to make sure no one so much as breathes on your windshield. I've owned 4 cars, all pieces of absolute garbage, and all purchased with whatever loose change I could scavenge from couch cushions and broken payphones. They were all junked after a year or two of having been driven into the ground and destroyed by life on a crowded city neighborhood street. It's totally the worst, and I want to finally own a car with power windows that doesn't have a fucking tape deck. Every once in a while, I get really tired of the city. It typically coincides with getting really tired of absorbing the projected rage of entitled assholes with purebred dogs, but occasionally I'll see a horse or a flower through the grease-spotted window of a crawling Amtrak train and daydream longingly about a car I can park right up next to my front door and a pair of elastic-waisted jeans I can pull right up next to my tits as I crush potato chips to go on top of the tuna casserole I am making for dinner. This is not to suggest that I am cosmopolitan by any means, but I do live in a bustling metropolis where dudes stand over you on a crowded bus with precariously gripped open containers of hot coffee, and having cool hair is of primary importance. I am always on the lookout for signs that I am aging disgracefully, and my constant agitation at all of the congestion and noise and close proximity to other actively sweating humans is proof positive that I don't have long for the second city. But could I really make it in a small town? Pro: I would be rich. When I was hanging out in unincorporated Missouri with my friend Lara, I saw a house for rent for $500 a month. An entire house. For rent. For less than I paid for the glasses I'm wearing right now. Is this real life? I pay almost twice that every month for a couple of rooms and a kitchen whose some square footage is probably less than that of your garage. What I'm trying to say is that I could have a house with a driveway and an upstairs for the price of half an ounce of La Prairie neck cream. I weep thinking of how little I'd have to work to maintain my basic quality of life in a town like that. 50 out of the 168 hours of my week are spent mad because work is interfering with all the internet articles I'm trying to read. 49 are spent trying to get some sleep if I'm lucky. 10 are spent suffering through some sort of commuting nightmare. 8 are pure panicking. 11 are brooding, and the last 40 are eating, shitting, writing, reading, watching, wishing, hoping, and hating. What is it all worth? Sure, I have money to buy an iPhone, but no time to figure out how the hell to use the passbook. If my rent was less, I could work less, and working less means I could shave a couple of hours off the time I have set aside for moping and sort out how to set a recurring alarm. Con: I don't know how to fix small engines or any other worthwhile small town shit. Where would I work out in the middle of the heartland? I whine and complain about my job a lot, but let's be real. I graduated high school almost 20 years ago, and since then, I have had a lot of jobs and not a lot of higher education. And I can't go to any more school. That ship has sailed, and I am thrilled to be left standing in its wake. I didn't like school when it wasn't weird that I was there. So the thought of sitting next to your daughter in Intro to Psychology makes me want to die for real. I can do fractions, but not when your son, that smug little bastard, is smirking at my gray hairs. Maybe I could go $100,000 into insurmountable debt at one of those quick colleges they advertise on television during Days of Our Lives. I could be a medical assistant, I guess, if I tried real hard. but I would rather mop 100 fast food floors than ever awkwardly try to make friends in another goddamn cafeteria. Pro, everyone seems so dang nice. The first time a Michigan person gave me an enthusiasm